Observers say Israel launches a new attack on Aleppo, killing more than 30 people and wounding others. The news comes as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is ready to resume ceasefire talks with Hamas. Plus, Russia launches a massive attack on Ukraine's energy infrastructure.
Ukraine Air Defense said it shut down 84 of the 99 drones and missiles launched.
And why did Russia veto a UN check on North Korean sanctions?
There can be no justification for disbanding the guardians of the UN's DPRK sanctions regime.
Today is Friday, March 29th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Hello, I'm Steve Miller, in for Steve Karish. The Syrian army says Israeli airstrikes near the northern city of Aleppo have killed and wounded several people as well as causing damage. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is an opposition war monitor, said Israeli strikes hit missile depots for Lebanon's militant Hezbollah group in Aleppo's southern suburb of Jibreem and a nearby town that houses a military facility, killing at least 36 people and wounding more. There's no immediate statement from Israeli officials on the airstrikes. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that Israel will return to the table for ceasefire talks with Hamas. Friday's announcement marks yet another attempt to reach a deal with the militant group that would pause Israel's military offensive in Gaza in exchange for the release of Israeli hostages. Several rounds of negotiations have thus far faltered. On Thursday, Israeli military spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said that the army had assassinated Hamas leader Wade Tebet, who was one of the 10 most senior Hamas military commanders. He said Tebet served as the head of the supply and personnel corps of the military arm of Hamas. In the past, he served as the head of Hamas's production system and is the organization's center of knowledge regarding equipment and ammunition. Hagari said he was killed inside the Shifa hospital in Gaza City, along with two other Hamas militants. Israel has been carrying out large-scale operations in Gaza's largest hospital for the past week. Also on Thursday, the World Court ordered Israel to end spreading famine in Gaza, demanding it take all necessary and effective action to ensure basic food supplies to the Palestinians there. Reuters' Diane Toh has that part of the story.
The unanimous ruling from the International Court of Justice came as aid agencies say only about a fifth of needed supplies are entering the war-shattered enclave. The World Court judges said in their order, quote, "The court observes that Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only a risk of famine, but that famine is setting in." The judges said this could be done by, quote, "increasing the capacity and number of land crossing points and maintaining them open for as long as necessary." The court ordered Israel to submit a report in a month to detail how it had given effect to the ruling. The new measures were requested by South Africa as part of its case that accuses Israel of state-led genocide in Gaza. A senior Hamas official said the ruling did not go far enough and Israel must be ordered to end its military offensive to halt the suffering, saying, quote, "We welcome any new demands to end this humanitarian tragedy in Gaza and especially in the northern Gaza Strip, but we hope the court would order a ceasefire as an absolute solution to all the miseries our people in Gaza are living through." The UN Security Council voted on Tuesday to demand an immediate ceasefire and the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages.
Abstention.
In a change from its previous stance, the United States abstained from but did not veto the vote. There was no immediate comment from Israel's foreign ministry on Thursday's World Court ruling. Israel has said it is making efforts to expand access for humanitarian groups to Gaza over land, through airdrops and by ship. But aid agencies say it's not nearly enough, and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the number of trucks blocked at the border as a
moral outrage.
Diane Toh of Reuters News. Overnight, Russian forces launched 99 drones and missiles targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure, while President Volodymyr Zelensky announced Ukraine is preparing for a new major Russian assault in the upcoming months. Anna Chernikova has those details.
Early Friday, Russian forces launched another massive attack on Ukraine with drones and missiles of various types, including Kinjal hypersonic ballistic missiles. The main target of the attack was energy infrastructure in the western, central, and eastern parts of Ukraine. Ukrainian air defense said it shut down 84 of the 99 drones and missiles launched. Ukrainian Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal said the latest Russian shelling damaged the energy infrastructure in six regions, resulting in emergency shutdowns are in effect in some of the regions. Later, President Zelensky informed that the main targets were the Kanyiv and Dniester hydroelectric power plants. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in his interview with CBS News Thursday, said the situation at the front line remains extremely tough. Zelensky said, "The east of our country, where we used to have and still have the most dangerous areas out of all the directions in the country. The situation in the east today is stabilized as much as it is possible considering the fact of the deficit of certain weapons, ammunition, considering the fact that we are beginning the preparation and training of the brigades to certain important for us actions. We have stabilized the situation. It is better than it used to be 2 or 3 months ago." He added, "Russia will be preparing the counteroffensive. It could be the end of May or June. And before that, we not only need to prepare, we not only need to stabilize the situation. We need help now. We need support now." Zelensky also informed that he had a conversation with Mike Johnson, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, to discuss Ukraine's crucial need for U.S. new aid package. Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal said on Friday, Ukraine has received a $1.5 billion tranche of funding under a World Bank program, aimed at helping it pay for its budget and social spending as it defends itself against the Russian invasion. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken plans to go to France and Belgium next week to enhance unity among close U.S. allies in their support for Ukraine in its war against Russia and for Israel in its war against Hamas militants. Analysts say he faces a tough task. VOA's Cindy Sain has that story.
French President Emmanuel Macron stirred up a controversy last month by saying that it is imperative that Russia be defeated and that it should not be ruled out that the West may need to send ground troops into Ukraine, a suggestion the U.S. and Germany swiftly rejected. One expert told VOA that he believes Macron was expressing the view, often expressed by the U.S., that all options are possible, without meaning troops would be deployed in Ukraine anytime soon. Ian Lesser is vice president of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, based in Brussels. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
I mean, we're in a tougher moment in terms of the war in Ukraine, and it is imposing new challenges and new risks for escalation. In some ways, the United States and France are the most outspoken and the most forward-leaning on the question of support for Ukraine across the Atlantic. So there's every reason for us to be on the same page. But I think that meeting with President Macron will certainly be very important to codify that.
Meanwhile, Blinken will head to Europe next week as outrage there and elsewhere grows over the suffering of Palestinian civilians in Gaza due to Israel's war against the U.S.-designated terrorist group Hamas. Another expert told VOA that in Paris and Brussels, Blinken will likely face the complex task of having to listen to and reassure allies while maintaining support for Israel's right to defend itself. Michael Kimmage is a professor of history at the Catholic University of America. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
He's going to have to articulate strong support for Israel. I think Biden has been unambiguous on that point, but at the same time, be sensitive to some of the concerns that Europeans have in particular about Israel going too far or Israel not having a long-term strategy or of Israel engaging in human rights abuses in Gaza.
Another discussion top for Blinken and his counterparts is likely to be the terrorist threat posed by the Islamic State group, which claimed responsibility for the attack last week on a concert in Moscow. The U.S. dismissed as propaganda charges by Russian officials that Ukraine was involved in the attack. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
As mentioned on yesterday's program, March 29th marks a year since Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was arrested in Russia. In a statement released on Friday, U.S. President Joe Biden said, quote, "Journalism is not a crime," and Evan went to Russia to do his job as a reporter, risking his safety to shine the light of truth on Russia's brutal aggression against Ukraine, end quote. He added that the United States will continue working every day to ensure his release. The 32-year-old reporter is being held in Moscow's Lefortovo prison, which is notorious for its harsh conditions, and Gershkovich appears in court every few months for hearings on extending his detention, explains Dasha Litvinova of the Associated Press.
The authorities still have not revealed the details of the allegations or evidence to back up the charges, which he and his newspaper categorically deny.
How much longer Gershkovich will spend behind bars remains unclear. He's widely expected to be exchanged eventually for a Russian held in the West, but it's impossible to say when that may occur. In Asia, after nearly three decades in Hong Kong, VOA's sister outlet Radio Free Asia has closed its physical bureau in the city and no longer has full-time staff there because of the declining press freedom landscape, according to a statement released on Friday. The announcement comes less than a week after Hong Kong enacted Article 23, a new national security law that media watchdogs warn will further erode press freedoms in the city. RFA, which opened its Hong Kong bureau in 1996, specifically cited Article 23 as a reason behind its departure from the city. VOA has reached out to the Hong Kong Security Bureau for a comment, but has not received a reply by our publishing deadline. And coming up later in our program, saying goodbye.
Stumpy was in the article, and it sounded like just a cool, interesting tree and something that I wanted to come see before he gets removed for the restoration project.
This is VOA News. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Turkey holds nationwide local elections on Sunday, with longtime President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AK party looking to regain control of Istanbul, Turkey's main city, and his one-time stronghold. As Dorian Jones reports, the outcome of these local elections could set all of Turkey on a different path.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is leading the campaign by his Justice and Development Party, or AKP, to elect Murat Kurum as Istanbul's mayor in Sunday's poll. Kurum promises to build 500,000 new houses to protect Istanbul from the threat of earthquakes. Incumbent mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu of the main opposition Republican People's Party, or CHP, is warning the return of AKP rule would result in uncontrolled construction.
Büyütülmüş sorunların çözümü için önemli.
İmamoğlu said, "This election is so important to address the unresolved urban problems. It is important for the solution of these problems that have been magnified." İmamoğlu's shock election victory in 2019 ended Erdogan's 30-year domination of the city. It was possible thanks to a broad electoral alliance of a pro-Kurdish party and Turkish nationalists. But that alliance collapsed after it failed to defeat Erdogan in last year's presidential elections. Atilla Shalada is a Turkey analyst for Global Source Partners.
The opposition coalition has fragmented. Everybody and their uncle is showing a candidate. I think it's a testament to İmamoğlu's excellent capacity for campaigning and to Murat Kurum's rookie mistakes that it's either a dead heat or Ekrem İmamoğlu is a couple of points ahead.
İmamoğlu's campaign has been releasing Kurdish videos appealing to the Kurdish vote in a bid to rebuild his electoral alliance. With the opposition still reeling from last year's electoral defeat, retaining Istanbul, analysts say, raises the chances of challenging Erdogan again. Sezin Öner is a commentator on Turkey's Politikyol news portal.
Local elections in March 2024 gives hope that opposition
can once mobilize itself and at least protect some of the breathing spaces in metropolitan areas. It's important at this point for the opposition to protect itself, to protect the hope that there can be some time in the future a real change in the society, in politics.
As public discontent soars over double-digit inflation, Erdogan has been touring the country, urging his supporters to call their friends and relatives in Istanbul to vote. Atilla Yeşilada is a Turkey analyst for Global Source Partners.
If Erdogan wins Istanbul, the opposition voters will never bother to report to the poll. And then whatever Erdogan intends to do, for instance, to grant himself a third term, would be much easier because of voter neglect. Two, İmamoğlu is the closest thing to a rival in the next presidential elections.
Analysts say victory in Istanbul will further tighten Erdogan's grip on power. For İmamoğlu, winning will confirm his credentials as the man who can defeat Erdogan. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Russia on Thursday vetoed the annual renewal of a panel of experts that oversees the enforcement of long-standing United Nations sanctions against North Korea. The move comes amid U.S.-led accusations that North Korea has transferred weapons to Russia, which Moscow has used in its war in Ukraine. Both Moscow and Pyongyang have denied the accusations, but they vowed last year to deepen military relations. Speaking during the Security Council session where the measure was being taken up, South Korea's UN ambassador, Jungkook Hwang, accused Moscow of being more interested in embracing or encouraging North Korea at the expense of a nuclear non-proliferation process.
There can be no justification for disbanding the guardians of the UN's DPRK sanctions regime, consisting of multiple resolutions adopted unanimously by this council. This is almost comparable to destroying a CCTV to avoid being caught red-handed.
Now for a deeper dive into this development, International Edition host Scott Walterman spoke with Greg Brzezinski of George Washington University.
I would say in terms of Russian motives, if you assume the worst, the issue is that the Russians, there's been arms transfers from North Korea to Russia that's in violation of the UN sanctions, and so Russia is trying to get rid of the monitors. The United States and other Western allies have claimed that this is going on. North Korea and Russia deny it, but that's one reading you can have, that Russia is trying to basically block their own activities that violate the sanctions. Another possibility is that just in general, North Korea and Russia have moved a lot closer together as a result of the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. The United States and its allies are, of course, mostly strongly opposed to what's going on in the Ukraine. North Korea has been one of the few countries that has supported it. And so it might also be read as Russia's way of thanking North Korea for being one of the relatively few countries that support it on the Ukraine.
Makes sense. And China?
I think North Korea has long played Russia and China off against each other. And China doesn't want North Korea to move so close to Russia that it's much closer to Russia than it is to China. So part of China's motive might have been to demonstrate, well, China is also sympathetic to North Korea. China has recently China has recently been less supportive of UN sanctions on North Korea than it's been in the past. And of course, part of the context is also growing frictions between China and the United States. This has been, of course, on and off lately, but, you know, Beijing's attitude towards the United States and towards cooperating with the United States on the North Korea issue is quite different than it was in, say, 2006 when the sanctions regime started.
The U.S. State Department says this will only embolden the DPRK to act with further impunity and move forward with these programs. Do you think that's true?
I think that North Korea has been moving forward with its nuclear weapons programs, regardless of what the United Nations has done. I understand why the United States and others have wanted to sanction North Korea, but I don't think that the sanctions have ever really been very effective at preventing North Korea from doing what it wants to do. And if you just look at what it's done in the last decade or so, it's made very significant strides in terms of both its nuclear program, its missile program. So I don't know that the sanctions ever stop North Korea from doing what it wants to do. But at the same time, I think now that North Korea senses that it is more protected from international criticism by Russia and to some degree China, it's definitely not going to be decelerating in its progress anytime soon. I think the only thing that might, slow down North Korea is more efforts at rapprochement and engagement on the part of the United States.
Greg Brzezinski is a professor of history and international affairs, as well as the director of the Master of Arts in Asian Studies at George Washington University. He was speaking with my colleague, as well as the host of International Edition, Scott Walterman. And finally, it's cherry blossom season here in Washington, D.C. And amid the blooming trees along the tidal basin stands Stumpy, a cherished figure among the 1,400 or so cherry blossom trees adorning the area's monuments. The tree gets its affectionate moniker because it's really nothing more than just a skinny tree stump, but with a single bunch of blooming branches. While locals eagerly anticipate the annual blossoming of these trees, this year marks a bittersweet moment for Stumpy and his neighbors along the southern shore, as it will be their final display of blossoms. You see, the seawalls have been failing for decades around the D.C. tidal basin, and as sea levels rise, the tidal basin gets more and more flooded with each high tide, and it's starting to drown out the trees. National Park spokesperson Mike Litterist explains.
That additional 6 feet of water overflows the banks of the tidal basin twice a day, every day during high tide. It inundates the roots of the cherry trees, resulting in the deaths of many trees, threatens infrastructure like sidewalks. It's even forced us to close the Jefferson Memorial from time to time as the water overflows the walkways leading to the site.
And Eric Nessie read about the project and decided to visit.
Stumpy was in the article, and it sounded like just a cool, interesting tree and something that I wanted to come see before he gets removed for the restoration project.
Starting in early summer, crews will begin working to replace the crumbling seawall around the tidal basin, the area around the Jefferson Memorial with the highest concentration of cherry trees. The plan calls for 140 cherry trees and about 300 trees in total to be removed and turned into mulch. When the project is concluded, 277 cherry trees will be planted as replacements. Again, Mike Litterist.
As that mulch breaks down, it becomes soil, which provides nutrients for generations to come.
The $133 million project to rebuild and reinforce the seawalls will take about 3 years. And that'll do it for today's program. There's more, of course, 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and on our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, I'd like to thank you for joining us. And until next week, I'm Steve Miller. For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.